It is a sobering thought that even if we could stop all greenhouse gas emissions suddenly today, the effects of climate change would not stop as suddenly. Think of a long freight train and how long it takes such a train to stop, let alone reverse. We get a long view of climate change and our approach to it in a new book called Dangerous Years, Climate Change, the Long Emergency, and the Way Forward. It's the work of David W. Orr, who played a role in the creation of the Green Campus Movement. He's based at Oberlin College in Ohio, where he's the counselor to the president and professor emeritus. David has written 8 previous books and edited or co-edited 3 more. And he's the co-founder of the journal Solutions. So he's been talking about this for a long time. David Orr, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You mentioned the Paris Agreement in the very second sentence of the preface. Your thoughts on today and what you think might happen later today?
Well, it sounds as if President Trump is going to withdraw. It's not clear what he's going to do, and he's not a very predictable person in that way. So one hopes he would stay in the accord and keep us part of the international community that's dealing with climate change, but we'll find out in a few hours, I guess.
We will indeed. So, and in fact, I want to let our listeners know that here and now, here on the News and Information Service, we'll be going to the White House live after noon our time. So that'll be carried on the second hour of Here and Now today on the News and Information Service. So just in, you know, that's the political end of things. Just in the physical end of things, we obviously have built up some momentum here on what we're putting into the atmosphere. And so I want to come back to that freight train analogy, because we've it's not like we could really reverse things in a short amount of time, is it?
No, that's right. Carbon stays in the atmosphere for a long time. All heat-trapping gases, and there's 7 or 8 major heat-trapping gases. Water vapor, for example, traps heat. But carbon is particularly a problem because of the volume of it, and it stays in the atmosphere for very long periods of time. It weathers out, partly as a function of interaction with oceans, and in part because it's drawn down into plants and soils and so forth. But it's a long-term problem. We're now at around 409 parts per million. The level fluctuates a little bit, but nobody within hearing distance is likely ever to see a world in which it goes below 400 parts per million. And it doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, parts per million is a small amount, but it is the planet's thermostat. It controls the heat that is trapped from sunlight striking the surface and then what can escape back into space. So this is like nothing we've ever faced before. It's global. It is not just an American problem. It's a world problem. It's long-term. We're talking hundreds of years or perhaps longer before Earth's climate balance could be restabilized. And so this is not a crisis of the moment. This is a long emergency, as James Kunstler describes it.
Well, so on that basis, David Orr, how do you make the case to people to do something that they might not see the results of in their lifetimes? I mean, if they think, well, you know, why should I care? It's just going to keep getting hotter, even if we were to stop emitting carbon, period, today.
Well, it's a really good question, and it gets to the heart of human motivation. Think of 7 generations ago, if the founding fathers had had the same attitude about us, their posterity. And think of the makers of cathedrals and so forth. Humans do a lot of things that have to do with their children and grandchildren and generations unborn. And that's when we're at our best. And so our role now is to cap off the worst that could happen and begin the process of restoration and doing the things that we should have been doing a long time ago. We were warned about climate change decades ago. The first official warning to a U.S. president was given in 1965. And we still have no legally binding climate policy, and now we have a group of climate deniers that are apparently not familiar with the science in the White House. But there's every reason to act on behalf of future generations, and a lot of the benefits of energy efficiency and renewable energy occur right now. It isn't just the benefits for all in the future. Cleaner air, better prosperity, more widespread prosperity and jobs and so forth, all these occur as part of this revolution.
And I want to be clear, this is not a revolution just of technology. You are very clear that this is not just about technological transformation. It's bigger than that.
It really is. And in this way, it's a very different kind of thing. Let me say kind of by preface that if you look at the rates of adoption of renewable energy, wind power, and solar power, you're an optimist, because those have been happening much faster than anybody predicted. If, however, on the other hand, the other bookend of this on this shelf is if you look at the accumulation of carbon in the atmosphere still continuing, and the acidification of oceans and all the things that go with global warming, you're more likely to be a pessimist. And the problem that we have is both of those curves are true, but one is more true than the other. And so the question for us is, how do we deal with that long-term crisis? And so I've described it in Dangerous Years as a crisis in part of how we govern. I think first and foremost, it has been a political problem. How we think, and so it's an educational issue, and how we feel, and that's a matter of heart, and then how we earn our keep, and that's a matter of economics. It's a little bit like solving the quadratic equations that you had as a high school junior, a long time ago. You have to solve for a pattern to get the right answer. So we've got to do a lot of things, but we should have been doing them all the time anyway. And Pope Francis, encyclical Laudato Si, a year back, described the scope of the changes, I think. And so I think it involves a civilizational transformation.
All right, we'll talk about what that transformation looks like. But is it fair to call you an optimist, David? You're not giving up on us, right?
Oh, not at all. I'm as optimistic as anyone. But a word optimism doesn't really work as well. It's hopeful.
Hopeful. Okay. We'll redefine what hopefulness means and what kinds of transformations we need to make other than the technological as we continue with our discussion about the book Dangerous Years, Climate Change, the Long Emergency, and the Way Forward. We'll come back and talk more with David Orr and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is David Orr, who has written many books about a lot of subjects, but he's a big believer in sustainability and being kind to the environment. His latest book is called Dangerous Years, Climate Change, the Long Emergency, and the Way Forward, in which he lays out ways in which we need to change our thinking as a species, really, to be able to reverse climate change. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And Mr. Orr, thank you very much for writing this book. I have some questions about timelines and reversibility. I have come across the writing of Guy McPherson. He is suggesting that we have a series of self-reinforcing loops that are already out of control, including the probable methane burps in the Arctic, et cetera, et cetera. Is there any basis for that as far as that goes? And is there anything we can do in the short term?
Thanks for that, Paul.
It's a good question. There are those possibilities. And, in fact, they're probabilities. At some level, warming, we melt boreal forests, and ocean warming will release methane from what are called clathrates. And when that occurs, methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas molecule for molecule than carbon dioxide. And so, yeah, those are real possibilities. The fact is we're playing Russian roulette with the future of the planet. And the most optimistic of the scientists that I talk with are 50-50 chance of making it to 2100 is not an uncommon prediction. But I don't think we can be paralyzed by those things. I'm talking on the phone from an entirely solar-powered building that we built back in the 1990s on the Oberlin College campus. In fact, it's not just solar powered. We produce a surplus of around 35% per year that's sold back to the electric grid. And that's in a state where sunshine is still something of a theory. So there are things that we can do. We just finished building a new hotel here, 105,000 square foot conference facility and hotel and commercial space that's powered entirely by an off-site solar array. And so the technology is a good friend. The first curve I mentioned a few moments ago, the rapidly increasing rate of adoption of solar and its various forms of wind and photovoltaic electricity and so forth, plus efficiency, are moving very, very rapidly. So it's within our power, if we had the political leadership, to cap off the worst that could happen and also build a whole new level of prosperity around renewable energy and regenerative agriculture and all of these things that we've been developing in the past a few decades. So in that sense, I'm an optimistic. I am optimistic. But I think we have to face the realities that you mentioned, that there are other possibilities. There are these feedback loops, and we're playing a very dangerous game with an Earth we don't fully understand. And it's what scientists call nonlinear, which just means in English, it's a system that will continually surprise us because we don't understand it and we don't control it as much as we might think we do.
You certainly get us thinking in your book. The book is called Dangerous Years, Climate Change, The Long Emergency, and The Way Forward. David Orr, our guest on The Exchange. You tell us that humans are fast thinkers but slow learners. And as far as threats to the planet, you actually think that nuclear war is a little more ominous at this point still than climate change. But climate change number two and unbridled artificial intelligence numbers two and three. Can we do them together? I mean, can we address all these problems at the same time, or do humans tend to be sufficiently slow thinkers or slow learners that we have to take care of one thing at a time?
Well, it's a good question. What we face, when you step back and look at the age, we face a convergence of some pretty awful possibilities. And I chose in Dangerous Years to focus on climate change because it's one I think that is most linked to the others and gives us the most leverage on the others. The transition to renewable energy and efficiency helps reduce competition for oil in the Middle East and reduces the pressure of long extended droughts and rising sea levels and so forth. So it gives us some leverage we don't otherwise have. But the dangers of nuclear war, Bill Perry, who was the Secretary of Defense and a man who spent his life in the defense industries, wrote a book 2 years ago on the dangers of nuclear war, and he put it higher now than ever before. And partly because we thought we solved it and have looked in other ways, but there are still tens of thousands of nuclear weapons on the planet, some not very well controlled. There's still some unknown number of what are called suitcase nuclear weapons or small portable nuclear devices in a world where we don't much like each other. And conflicts seem to be increasing. And you don't have to have much of a breakdown in leadership to cause real issues. And so North Korea and the United States are probably fairly close to a face-off of some sort with two people who I don't think are commonly thought to be highly stable and knowledgeable in the fray. Coming on the horizon, the issue of creating what some have called super intelligence, machines that are much smarter than we are, and at some point, as Norbert Wiener, the great mathematician, put it, they will not be kindly disposed to us. And we haven't begun to reckon with that threat, although we see it beginning, the outlines of it with battlefield robots and systems that are hyper-intelligent. When they cross the line to some form of sentience, we will not understand them at all. And I said in the book that they will not have had a stubbed toe, a broken heart, or a pet dog. It'll be a totally alien kind of intelligence. It will not be the kind of cute, fuzzy R2-D2 creature that we see in Star Wars movies. It'll be something potentially rather more sinister.
So these are the concerns, the ways in which we address them. You give us a bit of a to-do list here, and fixing democracy is certainly high on that list, and reorganizing the economic system. So I want to ask together, do you think we identify democracy and free market capitalism as essentially completely intertwined?
Well, they're not necessary to each other. They occur somewhat in tandem, but you can have democracy with many different kinds of economies, as we're learning. We're organizing here at Oberlin four national meetings on the future of American democracy, starting in November and then extending through the spring and summer of 2018. The first is here at Oberlin College in Ohio. The next will be in Denver. The third will be in Los Angeles, and the fourth in Atlanta. And what we're asking, we're bringing together kind of a headline group of people to focus on how did we get to the election of 2016? Because Donald Trump, whatever one thinks of him, Donald Trump is a symptom of deeper problems. He's a bit of an outlier, but he's symptomatic of things that go way back in our history, certainly at least to the Southern strategy of Richard Nixon, and perhaps even back to the Constitution that valued people of servitude at the rate of two-thirds of an actual person, but giving them no vote and no rights. And so democracy has always been a problematic way to organize the public business, and now it's in peril. If we want to fight for it, and it, in this case, is a system that Winston Churchill very famously observed was the worst of all kind of governing systems except for all the others that had ever been tried. The issue for us is how do we restore a working or build a working democracy? And if I could compare this, say, to the Grand Canyon, on one side of the canyon there is a public strongly in favor of things that we describe broadly as sustainability. If you ask the public about energy sources, they're by a large majority in favor of clean energy. If you ask about economic equity, and they're strongly in favor of a much more equitable kind of distribution of wealth and so forth. And on the other side are public policies that don't reflect those public opinions. And so the bridge that connects what we think and what we want as people and what we get as citizens on the other side, that bridge is broken. And the task now is to repair the connection between what people really want and how to inform their discretion, as Thomas Jefferson once put it, which means education, and then what we actually get. And so there's a massive disconnect here.
We are talking to David Orr about his book, Dangerous Years, Climate Change, the Long Emergency, and the Way Forward, here on the Jefferson Exchange. It's a bit shorter than some of our usual discussions, so we have a few minutes left with David. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Pam and Dexter, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Well, after Donald Trump got elected for president, I had been kind of encouraging people that, you know, we have the power every time we make a purchase which way we want to go, and that in mass we really do have the power, the grassroots, because there's way more of us consuming than there are the top pushing their, you know, fossil fuels or whatever. So even though we might not have a president who is working on climate change and helping educate people about the truth of this danger, we still have the power if we in mass can get that out to each other. So that's kind of what I've been pushing since the election. But I'm really excited about carbon farming, where you do more perennial and no-till farming, as well as organic, to hold the carbon and actually sequester carbon. The Rodale Institute did a great study on that, saying it could basically sequester all the carbon that's being released. And then the system of natural capitalism, where we include all the costs of a product, all the ecosystem services are considered. So an example would be like the average item in your grocery store travels 1,500 miles, mm-hmm. but you can get, you know, an apple that's cheaper from New Zealand than from down the street. So that would be, you know, obviously switched around because it costs way more to transport an item, and also if it pollutes the water, you got to pay for that to clean it up. So it just seems like, you know, as the media and the big corporations are controlling the information we get, and the politics are controlled by big money, that we have an obligation to be the educated citizens in order to have a healthy democracy and to do everything we can individually and collectively to mitigate global warming and until we get political leaders that actually represent the will of the people instead of big money.
Okay, Pam.
Well, I agree. I agree with that. And you've pointed out that there are things that we can do. I would say, relative to things like purchasing, yes, we can vote with our dollars and purchases, and that gets us part of the way. Carbon farming, I believe in wholeheartedly, but carbon farming is dependent on two things. One are going to be natural factors, rainfall and heat. It's not doesn't take a lot of temperature increase and decrease in rainfall, for example, or massive increase in rainfall to turn ecosystems that used to be carbon sinks into carbon sources. And so a good bit of carbon farming depends on heading off the worst of the temperature changes that we could see. As far as all the other things, what I think is missing in the conversation, Pam, is a reference to government and politics. We're in a fairly dire situation because we failed as citizens to enforce the kind of things that we want and we need. And so this is the most massive political failure in history. There are things that we can do if given time to do them, but it's going to take government of a much more robust, transparent, and democratic sort, I think, to help lead the changes. I don't think the market will do it alone. Markets can help, but they're not going to do it alone. And so the big failure here is one of politics and governance, I think.
All right, we're talking to David Orr about his book, Dangerous Years, Climate Change, The Long Emergency, and the Way Forward. Here's a call from Tony in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. I know Mr. Orr is not a scientist, but he speaks to some of them, apparently. But I'd like him to be aware of the fact, if he wasn't, that it's generally the consensus is that the degree to which the Paris Accord, if implemented, and in fact that's a question that's still to be learned, if implemented, would reduce the amount of increase of the temperatures by 0.17 degrees Celsius. So if they say that's going to be increasing by 3 degrees, which nobody knows, and the mathematical models have been horrendously unreliable in the past, so we're supposed to believe them in the future. So if it's never, instead of going up by 3 degrees, it's going to go up by 2.83. And the fact is that this is just a feel-good gesture. It's not. It should be a treaty, and I think Mr. Trump would be well advised to simply pass it on to the Senate.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Tony. Appreciate that. David, thoughts from you?
Well, I think Tony's right. The Paris Accord was a step in the right direction, but it was not the step we would need to stabilize climate. And so I'm all for taking it. I'd be sorry if Trump does withdraw the United States from the Paris Accord. But Tony's right that this is, by all accounts I've seen, this is simply not going to be the impact that we need. But it is a step in the direction. It begins to create a framework and a precedent. And apparently we're not capable of making these kind of large changes rapidly. But I agree, it's inadequate. But that doesn't mean we don't take the step.
Which seems to be the line of thinking of Tim in Eureka, who sent an email, and he says, it seems to me that preventing climate change and preventing earthquakes may both be futile, thus predicting and preparing seem more profitable. That said, the endeavor to produce clean, renewable energy and to bridle pollution is a good enough idea to be independent of climate change. That, again, from Tim in Eureka.
Well, I think it's I'm not sure I fully understand the point, but he's making... I think the reason for acting on climate change is the reasons, plural, are many. And if you want to start simply with self-interest, the green economy is a much more prosperous economy than the old fossil fuel economy. So if your interest is only is in making money, you can make more money, I think, in the renewable energy economy, more labor, more jobs in all sectors. If you're inclined to be moral about these things, it has to do with the kind of world we leave behind for those who follow us. Our children and grandchildren and so forth. And so there's a very strong moral component and religious component, as Pope Francis pointed out. If you're concerned about security and safety, there's every reason for us to get off fossil fuels, disengage from that entire world, If we want to be involved in the Middle East, make it a matter of choice, not necessity. So there are lots of different reasons that converge on action, and the sooner we act, the better. And getting oil and coal out of our politics, which has been one of the major corrupting forces in American political life and in global politics. So there are lots of reasons to do it, and to do it rapidly and quickly and thoroughly, and change the nature of the American society and global politics as well.
There's a lot to think about in here, clearly. The book is called Dangerous Years, Climate Change, The Long Emergency, and The Way Forward. It is new on Yale University Press by David W. Orr, who is an assistant to the president at Oberlin College in Ohio and a professor emeritus there and long involved in the Green Campus movement. David, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeff, thank you.
All right, take care.